So, if you only heard about the conference here, you should probably really go to Künstlerhaus and see the exhibition, a couple of really, really wonderful and interesting installations and artworks there. And I hope I can start now. Can I? Okay. And one of the pieces in the exhibition in Künstlerhaus is by a team from Montreal, and Heather Kelly is part of the team. So we definitely will talk about the piece. We have one microphone now. I think we have to share it. So, Heather, we decided on the general topic of society, play, games, because you're grounded in gaming, in computer gaming. So I would like to ask you the first question, because that's really interesting for me. You became interested in computer gaming, not because, yeah, maybe you played computer games before that, but you were primarily interested in a very feminist and very gender-oriented approach. So actually you became interested in gaming because of your feminist theory background, and I would be interested in talking about that a little bit.
I would say that's roughly true. I did, when I was much younger, play games like Atari and things like that. And then I kind of stopped when I was a teenager because that just really wasn't a very common or popular thing for a teenage girl to do at the time, unfortunately, would be playing video games. So there was this long span of time where I wasn't using playing any games, and probably not using computers very much at all, in fact, because of that. And then I became interested in it more in the late 90s because the internet was starting to really take off, and also there was this kind of girl power movement, and I thought both of those things were very interesting, and also was interested in women using technology more, and how can you motivate people inherently to use technology. And even back then we knew that games was a really powerful way to do that, games and entertainment. So I started doing some research on that, and kind of through luck, I guess, partly my interest in my background and partly luck, I ended up living in a city where one of the few companies that was making software for girls, entertainment software for girls, they started there, they founded there. And so I had done some research, and I was very excited and presented myself to them and started working with them. So that's how those two things kind of came together. But my interest in games and internet and things like that really took off again after high school, like when I was in college and getting into meds and news and things like that. So that's a roundabout way, not historically linear way of describing what happened.
Okay, so maybe let's really start like in a chronological order. Okay, so you're interested after high school, after college in online community stuff like that. When was that? Like, is this like mid-1990s, early 1990s, or?
Yeah, that was mid-90s, so everything was text-based. This is pre-web. So yeah, I was spending a lot of time at Georgia Tech, which is a big technical university in the States, and hanging out with geeks who got me interested in actually doing email and stuff like that, but very early. I mean, not early in terms of the whole internet, but certainly early in terms of normal average person's use of the internet.
You told me that you were doing pretty much a paper, I remember, on girls and technology. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
I wrote a paper, when was that? Probably like 94, 95. That was just my concept of what would be a very interesting entertainment application for women on the internet. And I think I essentially just pre-invented Second Life, or like the idea of Second Life. What a Second Life eventually was what I presented in this paper. Of course, they have no idea I did that, and I have nothing to do with them. But I just think it's interesting because I've been doing meds and news and thought, wow, if you could make this more graphic and allow people to create stuff on their own and be social that way and not just have it text-based, because I like text a lot, but a lot of people are more visual. So just kind of thinking about the social side of that led me to think that would be a really great application that would attract a lot of women to technology, and I'm pretty sure it has, although it's not, Second Life isn't like the only or the primary place where, you know, but yes, it seems to be true.
Okay. So, and as far as I know, because you did this paper, you wrote about it in a very theoretical way, and then you kind of saw the opportunity to do that like in real life, because I think you were hired by some company, or you were questioned by, or you thought that it would be possible to take that knowledge and put it into a game or something. Do I remember that correctly?
No, you don't.
Okay. That's why I'm here. Can I ask stupid questions?
That it really was more that the thought that I put into that was... The company that I mentioned earlier that moved to town, they're called Girl Games, and so they were interested in making games for preteen girls, so like tweens, I guess they call them. It's like a 10, 11, 12, 13 year old girls, and at no point did we really think about, I mean, the thing I'd proposed in this research paper was very blue sky. It was not anything at that time that was really possible. But I think they saw the potential that in the fact that I was thinking about these ideas, and so therefore it made a good fit.
Okay. How was the ratio? Because even today, there are not too many women working in the gaming industry. I mean, as far as I can tell, the bigger the corporations are, like Ubisoft or something, like corporations like that, more and more women, the bigger the corporations are, more and more women work for that. But if you go down to like the indie gaming and especially like underground computing, stuff like that, there are less and less women, like at the, let's call it like the underground bottom of, or am I wrong with that?
Or it's really hard to say. I think it's really hard to say, actually. The numbers are usually around 10%. 10% of the employees in the games industry are female. Of course, that's different for different disciplines. Like, there's way fewer in programming than there is, say, in graphic design and art, visual art. It's harder to count with the smaller companies because it's, you know, if you have a company that's only five people, what's 10% of that, you know? So, I'm not sure.
I mean, men, like, and I'm a man, and I know many men. So usually you have this strange, that the smaller the structures are, the smaller the companies are, the smaller the underground circles and communities and hacker cliques and stuff like that is, the less women are there, because it's like, you know, it's me,
because
and,
it's the
me and my buddies. It's me and my buddies, and we do our shit, you know. And it's always hard, like, if it gets less, if it gets a little bit more formal, and if it gets a little bit more like it's me and my buddies, it's, as far as I can tell, it seems to be easier for women to, to work there.
Well, a part of me doesn't actually know the factual answer to this, and part of me is also rebelling against the truth of this, because I would rather there were a lot more women involved in the more underground and alternative sides of things, the independent side of things. I do think there's an increasing number now, so there were like 3 or 4 years ago, but yeah, I think generally that might be the case. There's not as many. There are definitely some women though in the smaller things, because I think it's becoming much more of a viable way to create.
In the meantime, we can see that there's a huge DIY movement, and I guess that's also happening in the gaming world, I guess. That's like indie gaming and stuff like that, where people who are not necessarily interested in making money with games, but just like try to play around and do stuff. And
some of them want to make money.
Okay, yeah. But is that helping? Is it like, is something like the equivalent of like the hackerspace movement in the gaming world, is that helping women to actually just play around, try to do creative, interesting stuff, and then actually get stuff done and actually being supported by other factors?
I don't know, because I can count. Part of it is there's a bit of anonymity to that. If you're doing something very DIY, there are no things like hack spaces for games, which is kind of sad, but there are sometimes games made at hack spaces. So you don't really have that visibility. Most people that are doing this are kind of sitting alone, and you don't necessarily know they're doing that or what gender they are. So whenever I do find out that there's somebody who's doing their own DIY games who's female, I'm very interested and try to support them. But you have to first know that they exist.
So you only can mentor people if you actually know.
If you know
where
they exist,
are,
yes.
What they do.
I would venture to say that, yes.
Okay, good. There are two sides of that. There's the one side of women being interested in doing their own stuff, coding and creating games. There's the other side of this multi-trillion dollar market of people buying games. And even there is a big difference between how many male consumers are there and female consumers. So, as far as I know, you were involved in a couple of major projects, major games, one about Star Wars, I remember. There are ways to support females, not only because they are involved in the gaming industry, but also because they have female lead characters and stuff like that, or characters they can relate to, because it's not only... there's this interesting test called the Bechdel test, for movies. It's a test where you see how many women are in the main plot of a movie. Do they talk to each other? Do they talk about something else than other men? And then you can have this really interesting formula to see, oh, that's a very male-driven movie, or that's a movie that's actually opening and expanding. And it's interesting to see how many movies fail the Bechdel test. Yeah, and really good ones. The Bechdel test for computer games, that's a horror story, I guess, or?
Well, you might have to have, because games have different parameters than film, you might need to decide what your factors are for the equivalent of a Bechdel test.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know, I don't think you could apply the same thing to a different form with a different motives, and so... We could probably decide and think of some, but I don't think that the exact terms of the Bechdel test are.
But it's so interesting to see how many lead female characters in computer games there are. There's Metroid, and in the end you find out that you were playing a girl pretty much all the time, because
in the end of the first one, and after that you hopefully know that you're a girl.
But still, that's something many people know. Whoa, that's it's something special. The Metroid character, she's a girl, and that's something. That shouldn't be a big deal in the meantime. We are in 2010 and not in 1985 now, but still.
Well, I don't think it's as big a deal now as it was when that came out. Because, they spent the whole game not showing you and playing on your assumptions, because you assume your character is male, and then at the end it's a big reveal. It's the big secret. So I think it caught people's attention for that reason, and then it's just that character over time has developed that mythology. But I don't think it's quite as shocking anymore. It's a huge can of worms, because there are a lot of female lead characters in games, and they're usually very hypersexualized. But then so are the male characters usually.
Six packs, you mean, or something?
Or whatever, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Big guns.
Well, the plasma rifles. It's kind of an erotic. Component to that. Yeah, they look like penises, that's right. Yeah, but that's part of the whole first-person shooter narrative, that you have your guns and all that stuff. So do you see any interesting changes in that? Because you're not only... I don't want to reduce you to your work in feminism and games... because you're part of a collective called Kokoromi for a very long time. You're one of the co-founders of Kokoromi. And that's, I guess, to a certain extent, your mentoring part. Because you have competitions. Kokoromi is calling for the Gamma thing. And that's, in a certain way, encouraging people to write their own games. It's a competition. You present
it's a curated game challenge.
Curated game challenge.
Yes, it's not a competition.
Oh, tell us about that. Because that's a very liberating approach. It's not specifically about women, but it's just go and make your own games and let's see if they're cool or not. Let's talk about that.
Okay. So I and three other people formed a art game collective Kokoromi about 4 or 5 years ago in Montreal. And the idea, well, it's in general to promote games as an art form. And our best known event or effort in that regard is called Gamma, and it's this curated game challenge. The idea behind it was we wanted to get Indian experimental games out into the rest of the world so that it wasn't just only other gamers playing these little indie games. And also kind of wanted to make something that had a coherent feeling to it. So we wanted to have an event where the games would be serving as the visual content, and there would not be any VJ, but there would be music and dancing and bands and drinking and people. And so we put this event together to we thematically unified it by asking people to create games specifically for this event that they knew would be shown in large projection, and put some restrictions on it to make it more social, like keeping the games short, they have to be under 5 minutes, keeping the controls very simple. We standardized the controls so everyone had to use like a certain controller. It can't have any tutorial, it can't have any dialogue, it can't have any, that's an iffy thing. And it can't have any audio, because we knew there would be a lot of music, and nobody would have headphones on playing this game in the club. It would only be the music from the DJs. So with those restrictions, we issued a call for people to submit work, and didn't have any idea whether anyone at all would or what they would submit. They did, though, however, and maybe the most important thing that I left out is that we also would put in a sort of creative/technical challenge to thematically unify everyone. So in the first year, all of the games had to take the incoming sound from the DJ, in fact, and feed that into their game as a data signal and turn it into some kind of gameplay element. So instead of it being just creating visual feedback or doing something to the graphics, it had to be like, if you unplug the DJ's music from the game, you can't play it anymore, because that information is directly creating some form of gameplay. And we had 7 games that actually were submitted that year, and things like using the music, the waveform of the music as a rainbow on which a leprechaun riding an anglerfish would ride. One was called I Have Big Balls, and it was like you were playing sumo wrestling with a glowing fuzzball and trying to push the other fuzzball off of this playing field, but the playing field was affected by the sound waves. Or there was another one where the sound created asteroids, and you're in a ship and you're flying around. It's a 4-player competitive game where you're flying around in space, and every time there was like a bass beat, it was creating asteroids in your way that you had to dodge out of the way of. So things like that. And that was the first year. I won't go into every detail of every other year, but the general idea was we wanted to have a dual purpose of getting indie developers to think about this particular social and creative situation of this event with music and with games in projection and having it very social, and also wanting to therefore encourage people who wouldn't normally come to experience games to change their mind about them. And I think it's done pretty well for that.
Yeah, like another challenge was to create 3D games. So games were used as like stereoscopic
anaglyphic stereoscopy. Red cyan 3D.
That's interesting. But the interesting part is, and that's I guess the core element, it's a competition and it's about social gaming. So it should be able to play it in a loud, noisy, not smoky, it's still North America.
I don't think the smoke would have inhibited the games in any case.
You could have like smoke detectors and feed that into the games or something.
That's true.
Who knows? Why was that necessary?
That's a good idea for Vienna, actually. Create a game that requires a smoke-free environment in order to be played, and the game is so awesome that you have to choose whether to smoke or play the game. There could be a market for that.
They would choose smoke.
Yeah. Well, they'd choose it and go outside, and the rest of us would have fun inside.
Yeah. Okay, so the social aspect, I want to talk about that, because when I first learned about the whole thing, and I didn't know too much about the indie gaming scene, was that's interesting, because one really interesting and fundamental aspect for me about computer gaming was always the social aspect, like sitting around with friends and fighting over who has like the NES controller and sitting together and doing that. But of course, like over time, many, many people sit at home and just like click, click, click and do their thing at home alone. So was it actually necessary to like to just make the statement of like, come on, let's do it together.
Bring back the arcade is really what it's about. Like, okay. In fact, the term new arcade got coined a few years later, and we often get grouped in with that non-movement. It's not a movement. But the difference being that many people are playing games very socially. It's just that they're playing them socially over the internet, so they really are, they're physically alone, but then they're actually in the game with, you know, hundreds of other people.
World of Warcraft or stuff like that. Or.
So there's that kind of social, and then there's the kind that we are more promoting, which is everybody physically in the same place and not necessarily all playing the same game. And there's also more of a spectator aspect to it, because if you're not playing, you're watching somebody else play. And that's the majority of the time you're not playing, because, you know, there's a lot of people.
So what would be the opposition between, like, gaming as an art, like you have something like the Kunstlaus exhibition that we like, where there are many pieces that are interactive and you can do stuff with it or play with it, in opposition to something like an arcade? Because that sounds like this old diversion between like something like it's pop or entertainment, which is do it for fun, and like this highly like bourgeois art thing, you know, like there's art and there's entertainment. And I mean, I don't like that at all. So, and you're a digital artist yourself, so what's the interesting?
Where's the question?
The question would be, what would be the difference between a media art installation where you can play stuff and the new arcade?
Beer.
Okay, good. That's very positive. I'm a bad Austrian. I don't like beer, but I think I could have
wine or beer.
Expritzter, yeah, that's right. Okay, so just one question, because I really would like to know how many people here know about that.
Oh, and music.
Oh yeah, and music. Okay, that's interesting. So it's like
maybe not though. You know, the arcade could be like, it doesn't have to have music.
Okay, how many people before we mentioned the term here have heard about the new arcade? How many?
It's something that only other indie gamers care about.
Yeah, but interestingly, it seems to be that the indie gamers are the ones who do really interesting stuff. It's the stuff that gets blocked on Boeing, and interesting things happening there. But then, most of the stuff is not ending at people who are like actually consuming, would be normal consumers of computer games. So people might know, World of Warcraft, but how many people know the cool indie games? Is there something about distribution? Is this, why is it? Why do not more people know about the really cool shit that happens in the indie gaming scene?
I don't know, you could say that of like any media. Why don't people know more about like your favorite band than they do about Coldplay or something? I mean,
let's make a test, another test. So none of the people who knew about the new arcade. Maybe name like two or three you think really popular indie games.
Okay.
And if they have played it or heard about it.
All right. Who's played Braid?
Interesting.
Of course, I know you played it. What's another popular indie game? Well, sometimes it gets blurry. That was a very easy one to determine as an indie game, but there's others that are a little... Okay, you could say something like, who has played Flower? Almost as many people.
There's some people who are in like part of the gaming scene, but there are also people like this guy here. I was not expecting that. Still? Interesting. Okay.
But there's a lot of gray area, because you could debate whether or not Flower is a very indie-spirited game, but it's actually funded by Sony, so is it indie at all? You don't even know.
That's a good question. Who played Braid but bought it? Who paid for Braid? Interesting. Okay.
That's about the same number, except maybe one.
Yeah. Anyway, the cool thing is that the guy who created Braid is now pretty much a millionaire. I mean, he created an indie game and he made so much money with it. That's
he's pretty rare because he can pretty much do everything himself except for some of the very expressive graphics. Mm-hmm. That's not very typical. So, and of course, that game was very successful. I as far as like financially what that means, I don't actually know.
Okay,
but
that would be an interesting question.
Wait, I want to ask about one more
game. Okay,
one more. How many people have played Passage? Yes? Okay, good. Robert, raise your hand. It's still not too bad. That's maybe like the other example of well, that one was free, so you wouldn't have bought it anyway, but an indie game that sort of got widely known beyond the borders of the insular game scene.
Okay. So it seems that both in the major gaming and in the indie gaming, I would like to call it major gaming because I like the major, you know, major record labels and stuff like that.
Didn't ask how many people have played any of those games, which, you know,
okay,
by comparison.
Okay, pick a really like a major.
You played the new StarCraft. I didn't play it, but okay.
Uh-huh.
Well, World of Warcraft. Yeah.
Okay. Tomb Raider. Any Tomb Raider, whatever, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, we're boring them. They're not like, whatever, just get on with it.
Okay, so it seems that computer gaming in the major league always is a team play because you cannot create a major computer game just like yourself. Like, that's what you, I guess, mentioned when you mentioned that the guy who created Braid pretty much could do all of it himself and then earn all the revenue from that, yeah?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, creating something like World of Warcraft, that's impossible for one person to do it.
Yes, yeah. It's impossible.
Still, as far as I can tell, also many, many indie gaming projects are group projects. There are few games that one person created. And one person is actually marketing and doing all this stuff. So as an art form, it's very interesting, and I definitely think that computer gaming is an art form, although a couple of artists, like, what was his name, this American movie critic who said that, like, computer gaming, what? Yeah. Roger Ebert said that, like, computer gaming will never be an art form.
He backed down from it?
Yeah.
I know, no more fun.
No more fun. No more fun. Okay.
He was like, maybe I shouldn't have said that since I've never played any.
Yeah, of course. That's the whole thing. Mm. So it seems that computer gaming as an art form is always a collective project. It's always about groups doing that. Is this not true? What do you think?
Major?
Any kind of gaming, like creating a computer game, is most of the time, like on a statistical level, it's groups doing that.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Do you know, comparable to people from the art world, like there are art collectives, are there people out there who do stuff like that, computer gaming, but as an art collective? So, or is it always like interchanging? So one time we have this guy who does the sound, and one time we have the coder for this, so it's always like interchangeable variables, or is it...
There's a, I want to say, Belgian or Dutch group, Tale of Tales. Does anyone, somebody must know whether, where? They're really mainly two people. Are they Dutch or Belgian? I'm really embarrassed. Dutch, yeah. They do some really interesting work because it's always kind of, it's not trying to be part of the indie sort of scene, which there kind of is, but to do game-related work or games that interest them in different ways. I'm sort of trying to find the words to describe why it's different, but for instance, they would do something really high-end 3D, but about a really banal subject matter, like an old lady walking in a graveyard is one of their very sort of name-dropped ones the most. What's it called? The graveyard. they also have a very political stance about why they're doing what they're doing, and but they change a lot too. Okay. So that's one example of a more of a collective.
But that's rather rare, I would say.
It is pretty rare.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because it seems from my perspective that usually it works in the way that usually like music bands would work. You usually have like one driving character, like the lead singer or something, and then some like the let's say the Trent Reznor of a gaming circle or something like that, and the players, the people who play the guitar or bass or whatever, they are pretty much interchangeable, and you always have like one strong person who's like driving a certain aesthetical practice, I would call that.
Is that really how bands work?
I don't know.
I'm sure many people in bands would disagree.
Most of the time they end up like that, or they just like split up. Mm-hmm. Because what I would be interested in, that's why I'm asking all this question, is there something like...
is there like a natural organizational format for this kind of thing?
Something like that, or is it just very...
It's because of the specificity of games needing the programming and needing graphics, and sometimes usually needing sound, but not needing it as much. You'll have some people that will specialize in one or two or three of those, and then they'll either be able to do it all themselves, or they will collaborate with the person that has the other abilities. And so you'll often see duos and trios, I guess. Two or three people is way more common on this scale than four people or more.
So like the Lennon McCarthy model of creativity.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
McCartney.
No, because I'm doing a little bit of research. What?
You said McCarthy.
McCarthy. Ah, that's right. Yeah, that's a possibility too. Yes, I guess. No, I'm very interested in that because I've done a little bit of research in the last years about how art groups work. And there's always like one or two main figures that are almost like a double star system who have like a certain like kinetic group energy in a certain way that focus collective efforts. And then you usually have two or three or four or interchangeable other characters who somehow work with that. And that's quite interesting because it's quite stable. There are art groups out there who work for 20, 25 years in that configuration. And I was interested in, is this comparable to stuff that happens in collective processes in the gaming world?
So far, I'd have to say no. That isn't very common. Maybe because there is, up till now, more of a commercial imperative, or there's a lot at stake. I'm trying to think of anybody that's even been around for 20 years doing the same thing with the same people they used to do. You know, and that's hard for me to think of. You think of companies like id, and they're very personality driven, and you become aware of these, you know, John Romero and John Carmack and all these people, but you don't think of that as like a sustained collective. It's more like they're the superstars and they have big fights, and then, you know,
and that would be such a double
and then they make all this money and then they like crash because it, you know, so there's not as much of like value placed on this like shared aesthetic vision, I can't think of any good examples of people right now that are doing what you're describing, because it's a little more commercially focused, and when things fall apart, people separate and go do other things.
Okay, is it actually possible to compare stuff that's happening in the gaming industry? Let's talk about let's reduce it and say about indie gaming that's comparable to the art market or to the art scene. Because sometimes I have a little bit of a problem to see the differences and at the same time see what's actually working in the same way. Because, as you say, it's mainly about like creating a product and selling it. But in art, that's the same. But art is a scarcity market.
Right.
And gaming is like you sell as many copies as possible.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, there isn't a parallel market like that, because the games simply move into the art market that already exists.
Mm. Because there's more money, or why is that?
I wouldn't say that. I would just say that if the kind of game you're making, it's the choice of the people that are making it. Like, oh, well, we want to make a game that we can't actually sell on a downloadable, or we don't want to bother to sell it that way because it's a lot of effort to get your game not distributed. Distributing is easy, but getting it marketed and getting people to pay for it is a little harder because you can do it for free, get it for free. So I think people just for different reasons choose which route that they want to pursue the sharing of their work.
Okay, in your personal case, you created computer games, but you're also doing digital art, like being shown at the Künstlerhaus now, or actually it got destroyed yesterday.
If you want to enter that part of the conversation.
Could you tell maybe a couple of anecdotes of why certain things that you create you define as digital art and some stuff is indie gaming? So how do you make the difference between how... Or is it just like a method of like product placement in whatever fits better?
Yeah. Gosh, I haven't really thought about it this way before. I'm not even actually sure I can answer it. It's like, why do I... Like, each thing that I've made, it just... Often for me, it's because I'm interested in things other than the capabilities available in, say, an online distribution or over a console or something. Like, they'll all have some kind of other element that is only possible to do in the real space. And I am also interested in the social aspect of things, and I've done other installations at events and things like that. So it's more like the form that I want the end result to have is especially appropriate for the art context as opposed to the game for sale context or download.
I mean, you did or were part of an effort to do a computer game or a computer game installation about female orgasm. I really liked it. I think it's Lapis,
yeah.
You call it, yeah? So could you talk a little bit about that? And let's add the question, why is that art?
Why is that? Well, the why is it art question, I mean, that's always, to me, we could just get into like a sheer philosophical debate about, well, why isn't it? Well, what is art? Well, you know. So I'm not sure exactly how I would answer that. Everyone must answer that for themselves in a way. But Lapis is a game concept that I first proposed for the Nintendo DS in answer to a challenge to create a game with a sex theme. The concept was to, if you know the Nintendo DS, it's the small handheld device with two screens. The bottom one has a touch screen that you use a stylus, and then the top screen is a display of approximately the same size. And the idea was that you would have this image of this cute character on the bottom touch screen, and say in the demo, it's like a very adorable bunny rabbit. And by tickling it or scratching it or rubbing it in certain ways, you would make the bunny very happy, and it would fly to its happy place, and you'd see that on the top screen. But it's all very metaphorical. There is no graphic sexual content. It's meant actually for females. So it's not porn, actually. It's really about maybe it could be a simulation of masturbation if you... we're able to make the gestures and the movements somehow accurate to the actual physical gestures and movements that you want to perform. But the visual feedback that you get is more just about the feeling of joy. And then the installation that we did was taking that idea from this small device and installing it into a 360 projection environment, where you could stand in the middle of it, and it would be the bunny is in front of you in projection on a table, and you can interact with it there. And then with that, when you are pleasing the bunny, you are sort of flying straight upward, and so you're getting a view of this changing sky all around you. And also there's kind of symbolic content like... Well, in the two versions, there was very different content But it's more just fun, playful, cutesy, I wouldn't say Hello Kitty type, but not quite that cutesy, no like, you know, pink bows or anything, but it's more fantastical types of things as you fly up through the air. And then if you succeed by changing your style or, you know, adapting to the situation, then again, same gameplay really is that you take the bunny and get to the happy place. So really, the environment was very different. The gameplay was able to make the transition because it is this sort of touching thing with this upward flying, and that's why it just really translated quite well to the environment. And that was almost, you know, it wasn't something that I chose. It was like, hey, make a game for this 360 production environment. And so it just really worked out that the verticality of it worked.
It's really interesting that you designed it for the Nintendo DS, because like the final product, like the final installation itself, of course it's completely different. And I think it works so well and looks so great because you're actually walking around in the thing and touch the bunny and help it.
We probably, I don't know if you did the videos, but we do. I mean, all these things you're talking about, there are videos available if we wanted to show them. But
we could. Should we? Should we? Oh, you can do that, yeah. Okay, then I'll try to set it up. In the meantime, another question until it's done.
Okay.
So tell us a little bit about your installation in the Künstlerhaus and your team and why it's broken.
Yeah, I want to do a little show and tell. So while you're doing that, I'm going to go get my device, but I'll be right back. A different device. So the game that's up at the Künstlerhaus right now is called Fabulous Fabuleux, and it's a game that uses a rather complicated and sensitive squishy ball. So the player uses only this soft squishy interface to find, it's like a connect the dots game in three-dimensional space of the room. So there's these invisible spots around the room. You follow an audio signal that tells you kind of like hot, cold, like hotter, but it's using different musical sounds instead. And then when you find one of the places that you're looking for, the game gives you some feedback that you're in the right spot, and then you squeeze this squishy ball, and it sort of makes a star appear in the sky. At the same time, it knows where you are in the room at all times, and it has it's drawing this trail of stardust wherever you go. It's quite beautiful. And it's broken. it was a really great show at last night at the Künstlerhaus. I don't know if everybody was able to make it out there. And there was a adorable 8-year-old girl who really loved the game and was playing it almost nonstop for about 2 hours. So there's that. Yeah, you can play it. It has a lot of fun in the back. You can watch it. It's pretty good.
Fabulous is a 3D version of the classic puzzle game Connect the Dots. A player moves around the room holding a wireless physical interface that we call a squisher, a soft, squeezable ball that contains various sensors. He or she follows a hot, cold sound clue to find a hot spot in the room. And on finding it, squeezes the ball. A squeeze in the right spot produces an orb, a star-like object in the 3D space of the screen. The sound clue then restarts for the next orb. The player gradually finds a constellation, and when this is complete, the corresponding 3D object is revealed on the screen. This object can be rotated and looked at from all sides by rotating the squisher. The objects in this particular version of the game have been linked by two very minimal narratives. One, a classic children's story of vanity, punishment, and redemption, runs in script across the bottom of the screen. The other, a contemporary version of these themes, is spoken.
Falling stars are fading quickly in the west. What is our modern about? Where do old stars go?
So you think you're in this, and then the freshness?
The texts are delivered incrementally as the player progresses through the game, like layers of a puzzle. Fabulous is just one example of what can be created using the Connect the Orbs game template, which has been built so that it is simple to change the story, objects, and sounds to different ones. In Connect the Orbs games, the physical space of the room is as important as the virtual space on the screen, and the sound is as important as the image. The games also have a strong element of free rather than goal-oriented play. As the player moves around the room with the squisher, a trail appears on the screen and he or she can choose to simply draw on the screen. Movement around the room with the squisher interface produces both a drawing on the screen and a kind of free choreography that other spectators can watch. Although only one person can use the squisher at a time, the size of the environment, the trail, and the nature of the sound clues all make Connect the Orbs games a very entertaining experience for spectators who often participate by encouraging and prompting the player.
Yeah, well, especially when you're 8 years old.
But 8 years old and they're like drop kicking it, and it's like an 80-year-old and an 80-year-old.
Pause it here, yeah. Yeah, it was finished off by an 80-year-old drunk guy with a cane who drop kicked it, but last night was pretty epic.
The young girl, I think it ran out of battery, whatever. She didn't like, sometimes she saw the squeeze thing,
yeah.
She knew what to do, and it didn't work. She tried to squeeze it, but she wasn't really in the correct whatever. So she, and then she put it on the floor and jumped on it and stuff. That's actually how you should treat art.
Yes.
Yeah. But
well, we tried to make it so that wouldn't matter, that was possible. Yeah. But I think we just learned. So, we had a good beta tester. She's
that's the thing that's broken or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. So I bought this. You can't really see, but I figured I was going to bring it anyway because I have to fix it. But there's a cube that has pressure sensors on three sides, and then there's these foam coverings that cover up, and so when you push on the foam, it senses that you're touching it. And since it's on three sides, it's basically on all sides, because when you press it, it's usually coming from two directions. And then inside is a custom designed and manufactured chipset, or I don't know exactly how to do it, circuit board. There's things like a Bluetooth signal and other things. And then this wire coming off of it goes to the battery, and actually I think what happened when it broke the first time is that the battery got smashed and bent. It's like a rather soft, it's not like a double A battery thing. It's kind of more fragile than that, as we've now learned. The pressure sensors aren't working on it right now. So unfortunately, the whole game works, but you can't actually play it without the pressure. You know, every little piece has its own system, and if any of those small systems breaks, then the whole game is.
Yeah. Let's hope that you can actually order something or try to build
or rebuild it. Hopefully Meta Lab will be able to.
Yeah, we already got offers from the Meta Lab yesterday to help fix the problem. Okay, should we show the Lapis one too? Because I only could find this your presentation here. Where is it?
Oh,
no,
we don't have that one. If you were on the Vimeo before, where was that? We should have had mine on it.
Okay.
Yeah. That's good.
Nope.
No? Yeah, okay. There, that top
there
one.
It is.
Yeah.
Ah, because it's French.
The event was a winter themed event, so.
Come on. So. Ta da!
Well, already described it, so you can see that there's some cupcakes in the sky. One nice thing actually to note about this whole experience was that it kind of was the origin of Kokoromi, because this was what we did when we met, and it sort of showed us that social gameplay was interesting and that people enjoyed interacting with this thing in a an atypical environment of a nightclub, and that it was especially good because it drew other people were drawn in to see what was happening, and then they would have enough time to sort of figure it out by watching, and then they would play. So it was not that sort of inhibition you get in a gallery where people are just sort of like staring back and don't want to do anything. It was very easy to get into.
Shoes are recurring objects. There's the shoe in
I never noticed that, but you're right. Shoes are sexy. Okay, so we are already over 45 minutes of talking, so I would like to open up questions to the audience. So cool. I'll get your handheld microphone, you get that one. Any questions? Come on. I can't believe that my questions were so good that you don't have any additional ones. Okay.
With the spatial installation of the bunny game, did you think about using maybe an actual bunny figure physical interface similar to the cushion you've been using now in your new installation?
Oh, that's a pretty good idea, actually. There has been some work done with, like at MIT Media Lab and things with sort of soft interface, stuffed animal type things. Hadn't thought about that before, but it's not out of the question. The only thing that would prevent that is just that I get bored easily and move on to another project, and so it's, you know, it would mean going back. Many people wish I would go back to Lapis and revisit and make Lapis real, or make it, you know, ship it on the iPhone or whatever. So there's maybe possibilities for that, but I tend to find a new thing to do. But yeah, it's a good idea. If anyone wanted to volunteer to make the interface, I would happily help them adapt my content to it.
Okay. Yes?
I have one question about these games who needed music, a music input. Was this music input done by a microphone, or was it the live plugged in?
It was live, a live line in from the DJs.
Because it would be very interesting if you don't use music, because many computers have a microphone built in into them, and so you could use the noise of the subway or something like that.
Yes, you absolutely could. I guess what some of the things you'd have to think about there is that. What is the music? What is the game listening for to create the content in the out of the music or out of the sound? Because some of them were using frequencies. So if it was listening for a certain pitch, you would. It was like, for instance, it was breaking it up into like the very low tones, mid range, and then the high tones. So you may end up, if you feed it something other than music, having a sound source that's only low frequencies for the most part, and then you'd have a very different experience. One thing to note about that challenge that I didn't say before is that it seems like an obvious thing, well, I'd make a music game, but you can't really make a music game if you don't already know what the music's going to be. It has to be, music games are generally already preloaded and you've analyzed the music and it's predict, like it knows what's going to go on. But if you have live music, you absolutely cannot make a music game out of it. You can't make a beat matching game or anything like that. You have to find another way to use that signal. But because of that very reason, it would make a very good, you could make adaptations that would use any kind of sound because it doesn't require the specific songs.
I have a question regarding also this game challenge, this curated game challenge in a club environment. Was it purely for entertainment, or because it seemed like you adapted it very well to the overall context, but was there also like a goal orientation? I mean, in a, let's say, kind of way, okay, we want the experience to end up in, let's say, people interact more socially or buy more drinks or meet each other, or I mean, there's like different kind of goals you could set to. Has any work done in that sense that you say, like, okay, with that game we actually achieve that random people meet, that I mean, there's typical, let's say, goals you have when you go clubbing, which kind of you can summarize in saying, like, okay, I want to have fun, but then there's like, you know, these different
We never had any formal measurable types of things like that, but we did actually think after the experience we saw here with the Panascope and Lapis, we realized that people that didn't know each other were now talking to each other and meeting through the game, and so we sort of always thought that would be really great as like a goal if like it becomes more of a mixer mingling thing where people are meeting each other and they would not normally have spoken or known each other, and they would have just done their own thing in the social environment, but now they actually have an excuse, something to talk about. And so I don't have any evidence, like I don't know if there's any, you know, gamma marriages or anything like that, but just anecdotally I've seen it happen, and there, in fact, over time we realized that the social aspect of it, bringing people together in multiplayer games, was very interesting, and always enjoy when people are submitting, because when people submit these games, they don't have any restrictions on how many players they can, like it's from 1 to 4, I think. There is a restriction, 1 to 4. Mainly because the controllers, you have to wrangle and get everything ready for the hardware. But there was never like a requirement that they only do a one-player game or only do a multiplayer game. And it's been interesting to see over the years how people that have become more familiar with what Gamma was. Like the first year we had 7 submissions, the second year something like 15, the third year 9, the fourth year 144. So like it really, people started to really get the idea of what it was, and we had a wide range of game submissions in terms of whether it's a one-player game or a two-player game, four-player. And we definitely enjoyed ones that really took the essence of the social environment and used that. There was one in the last, most recent.
Yeah, that's
Gamma.
My first time. It's
okay. Yes,
it's my favorite one.
Really?
Yeah, yeah.
Well, you might.
I played it. I beta tested it. I remember.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, the last one was called, the theme was one button games, so each player could only use one button, and like the button was like push or release, and to find out how far people could push that particular creative challenge. And the one of the ones that we liked the best and showed in the show this year was called Button, BUTTON, which stands for Brutally Unfair Tactics Totally Okay Now. And it's like a multiplayer competitive twister game, sort of. It's really hard to describe, and it's because it's so perfectly suited to this party or social bar-like environment. It's 4-player, it requires 4 players, and the game has you set down the controller, and then it gives you instructions like take 5 steps back, turn around, and then it'll give you a goal, and the goal will be like the player whose button is pushed third wins. And it's like, at first it doesn't make any sense, but it's total, when you're playing it creates total chaos, because everyone's standing away from the controller and everyone sees which controller is controller number 3 and which person is associated back to that controller, but there's no rule saying that only player 3 could push that button, or that you couldn't push somebody else's button so that you were the 3rd player. Like, it's just, it's amazing game made by the Copenhagen Game Collective. In fact, if anybody's going to be in LA later on this week, I think they're...
It's hell. Hell breaks loose. You have 4 people, and they have their... How many different like setups are there? Like 20 or something? 20 different... Or like how many like different levels of the game? They always...
Well,
like,
it's randomizing them.
It's
so
randomizing, but they're 20 or 25 different sets or something of rules.
I don't know.
But they
made more after Gamma, when they, like, so the new version has even more. Yeah. So it keeps you guessing.
It's so great to see that people don't actually like kill each other doing it because
yeah,
it's so, like,
I was really glad there were no like major injuries out of that game at Gamma because it also was very conducive to drinking. Yeah.
Button. B-U-T-T-O-N, but there are dots in between. Dot, U dot, etc.
So brutally unfair tactics, totally okay now. And I mean, the other thing is, with a game like that, and it's telling you to turn around and close your eyes and stuff, like, it doesn't make any sense, but, like, that's the rule, and so some people are going to do that, and then other people won't, and then
it encourages that thing, because it says something like, go five steps back, close your eyes, but you only can see what you have to do if you cheat and open your eyes and then
and then you can only see if somebody else is breaking the rules if you break the rules so it's like self-managed rule but it's amazing.
It's very good. Okay, maybe one final question. Is there one?
I guess earlier you were saying you weren't sure what the dividing line was between indie games and digital art. And then later you said, well, there are inhibitions when people get into galleries. So is the line just that you're expected to be serious?
That might be one of the lines. I don't know if I would say that's the only line, but I would say that's certainly one of the lines. It's like the cultural expectations of your behavior in the context, the white cube, you know. So that's why it was, for example, the first showing I gave of Fabulous yesterday morning, like, nobody wanted to step forward. I was like, hey, it's a game, we can play. And, like, everyone was just like, yes, I wasn't going to say that, but it was the journalist. When the show started, people were a little less inhibited. And then when the small child came in, people were way less, you know, she was not inhibited in the slightest. And so she was able to, through her magic, draw people in and get people playing. You know, it was a great boon to me for the first 2.5 hours. It was only like the last part that was maybe, people's inhibitions. Big difference.
Okay, I would say a big applause for Heather Kelly.